is Richard Parker. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, Oregon, working mainly in debtor-creditor areas. And I'm a member of the debtor-creditor section legislation committee.
You can sit down.
And I'm here to support Bill, House Bill 2061. This is essentially a technical correction to fix some errors that occurred during the renumbering and additions that have taken place over the past few years. The recent amendments have not picked up the fact that some of the exemptions that are listed here are to be doubled and some are not to be doubled. And that's caused some confusion in how to interpret the statute. One of the things that's happened is that it appears that we've lost the doubling of the $400 miscellaneous exemption. This is not a radical change in the law, just as a correction to put it back the way it should have been when the statute was first passed. And if anyone has any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
All right. Questions? I followed you. This is only intended to address the doubling of the $400?
Yes. Well, no, it's the doubling and non-doubling of all the sections that have been put into error by the amendments.
Okay. And just so that we go down these for a little bit, mm-hmm. so that, A, the $600 for the books, pictures, et cetera, you can double that.
Right. Okay. And, for example, the unlimited exemption has no need to be doubled, so that shouldn't be doubled.
That's the...
crime victim.
Which letter is that?
J?
Yes, victim reparation law.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Way back when, in my early law practice, I did a little bit of bankruptcy law, so I'm sort of familiar with these. But are any of these numbers that you would change, you think are too low or too high?
The section hasn't put me in a position to do that. All I can do is speak personally, but I think all of them are too low because the numbers are very old. At some point in the future, we might bring this before the committee, but that's not our point right now. It's just the technical correction.
I understand. The $1,700 for the vehicle, how long has it been $1,700?
Quite a long time, the whole time I've been in practice, which is 20-some-odd years, I believe.
It's been $1,700 for 20 years?
That's my recollection.
Somebody behind you is shaking his head no.
Uh-oh.
I'm not sure, but it's been a long time.
It used to be $1,200.
Looks like Jim Markey may want to testify.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
I won't give you any more quizzes.
Nationally, they're very low as compared to other national figures and much below the federal exemptions, which you've opted out of. For example, Washington State, I believe, is $2,600 for motor vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Do you know if the House took up those issues or talked about those issues?
Not that I'm aware of. And that wasn't the point of the bill.
All right.
We did not. I was in
the did not. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Parker. We'll hold this over since we obviously have no quorum to move the bill. And I don't know if Senator Ringo wants to explore the other issues or not. But,
and my written testimony has been submitted, Chairman.
All right. Thank you very much. That was pretty simple. Appreciate it. Okay. Close the public hearing on 2061, and we'll go to House Bill 2054. Jim, are you up on that one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. Jim Markey on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. House Bill 2054 is an attempt to codify what we believe to be the law of the land in Oregon presently, but it is a response to lawsuits which have been brought in other states and an issue that has been raised at least once in this state regarding collection agencies taking a case or suing on a case in small claims court in their own name on an account that has been assigned to them for collection purposes. ORS Chapter 9, specifically 9160 and 9320, require that an attorney be employed to prosecute a claim. There is an exception to that statute in the small claims statute in Chapter 46, which can be found at 46441 sub 5. However, in the state of Iowa, there was a lawsuit brought against a collection agency for suing in a small claims case in their own name on an assigned account because the assignment was for collection purposes only and they were receiving a percentage of the money, and there was a client that also benefited from the lawsuit or the proceeds of the lawsuit. It was deemed to be the unauthorized practice of law. And this issue's come up in several other states. In Iowa, the Iowa Supreme Court actually barred collection agencies from practicing in small claims court. This is would change nothing in the way in which things are done in Oregon presently, but it would strengthen the law by putting a statement in the licensing statute for collection agencies that they absolutely have the right to prosecute these claims in small claims and in small claims cases in their own name. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And Jim, I assume the Oregon State Bar does not disagree with this position.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I took this bill to the Oregon State Bar well ahead of the session, and they gave me their blessing.
All right. Senator Ringo.
Jim, just a question. Are most of the small claim trials, hearings, does the defendant present evidence as to why they don't owe a debt? Or are there evidentiary issues involved, or are most of them default judgments, or what happens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, the majority of them are defaults. Generally, I think people know they owe the money, and the amount's not disputed.
So people may request a trial,
absolutely,
and then show up, and it's just a default.
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, when I say the majority of them are defaults, by that I mean there is no answer filed.
I see. Okay.
Now, if there is an answer filed, the defendant has several options, and they can request a hearing in small claims, or they can request that the matter be put to circuit court. They can request a jury trial, any number of things. They can file a counterclaim, obviously. But the majority of them don't file an answer. But we do go through many hearings in small claims, and sometimes a defendant might request that it be moved to circuit court, in which case we'd be employing an attorney at that point. The corporation would be required to. Generally, those go to arbitration in circuit court.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions? All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is the committee okay on this? Right, okay. Work session, House Bill 2054.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I would move House Bill 2054 to be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2054 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. And Senator Starr, would you carry that bill?
Please. I'll do that.
Thank you, sir. All right, now we'll move into a work session, public hearing on Senate or House Bill 2087. Let's go back to 2061 just briefly, since Senator Burdick is here. And, Council, you want to explain the bill again?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2061 deals with a technical issue in the laws regarding exemptions from execution of debts. If you look on the bill, there's a series on the first page, a series of items that can be exempt from execution when you have to, when there's a foreclosure on a debt, books, clothing, tools, vehicles, domestic animals, household goods, certain property, and also health aid, spousal support, judgment debts. This statute has been amended a number of times, and it turned out that the exemptions no longer tracked the amendments, and so that there were certain things that could be doubled and other things that couldn't, and this this statute or this measure is meant to change that so that the correct items could actually be doubled, and such things as there's a kind of what they call a wild card exemption that was not meant to be doubled, and that is now taken out. There's a section at the very end about private property that before this amendment would be passed, it appeared that somebody who was married could actually take certain exemptions, and somebody who wasn't married couldn't take. That wasn't the intent. It was just that the amendments didn't quite track this list of items. And without a background, it,
that's good. That's fine. Senator Britt?
Mr. Chairman, could you, I'm misunderstood, on the wild card exemption, what is that?
There is an exemption at...
Mr. Chairman, I think, are you referring to the corner law?
Yeah, there's a distinction.
Essentially, when somebody files bankruptcy, they're allowed to claim as exempt property certain classes of things they own that are not subject to execution, that they wouldn't have to surrender. Otherwise, anything that's above those exemption amounts, they may have to surrender to the bankruptcy trustee. So it lets you keep a certain amount for clothing, for example, $1,700 in equity in a vehicle, and then the general exemption is $400 for anything. So you could keep a little bit in a bank account or whatever that is not subject to execution.
So this allows doubling of that jointly?
Yeah, if you file bankruptcy jointly, then the married couple together would have twice all those
numbers. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
I mean, I think this technical amendment makes a lot of sense. I would like to explore whether, I guess on the vehicle exemption, how long it's been there and whether it makes sense to increase it. And I guess I would appreciate your guidance as well. And also, frankly, if somebody was vehemently opposed to this, then I would probably not want to explore that. But is that...
Well, I guess my thinking would be we can hold the bill and spend some time looking at those issues, but I don't know that I want to mock up the bar's bill necessarily.
Yeah.
I thought we had another bill in the process somewhere that might contemplate doing that.
I don't know.
But, I mean, I'll leave it up if the bar wants to. Mr. Parker's left, so it's kind of unfair to him at this point to do that. But
could I just ask, Mr. Marquis, is that something you would have heartburn with, looking at those numbers?
Mr. Marquis, for the record, is shaking his head. Yes, he would have heartburn.
Okay.
Yeah, so. All right, so what's your pleasure, sir?
Let's pass the bill.
All right, we'll do a little work session. House Bill 2061.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brady.
I see no amendment, so I would move House Bill 2061 to the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Brady moves House Bill 2061 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any additional discussion? Any objections to the motion? None. And we'll, motion passes. Senator Ringo, would you carry the bill? Perhaps I'll give you a chance to talk with some of the various parties to prepare your speech. All right. Let's see. All right. House Bill 2087. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is another bar bill. It relates to amending rules of civil procedure and how the council on the court's procedure gives an opportunity for members of the bar to basically state their piece on whether they disagree or agree with the amendments to the rules of procedure.
All right. Mr. Stuart Brown. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Stuart Brown. I'm with the Oregon State Bar Procedure and Practice Committee. House Bill 2087 is a technical bill that corrects a glitch in ORS 1.735. That statute is part of the statutes that set up the Council on Court Procedures. That council promulgates pleading and practice rules for attorneys to practice in court. The problem is that presently, although the council has a notice period during which it is to send out proposed legislation to the members of the Oregon State Bar. Under the terms of the present statute, when it finally meets after the close of that comment period, it cannot make changes. And it receives a lot of very good suggestions from members of the bar to whom the proposed legislation is given. But under the present statute, it cannot make any changes before finally recommending the rules to the legislature. What this bill does is it changes that. It provides for a comment period, then a meeting. The Council on Court Procedures may then make changes to its initial proposed legislation. Then it resubmits that legislation with the changes to the members of the Oregon State Bar in a notice format, basically saying this is what we're going to recommend. So what this bill does is it allows two notice periods and the ability of the Council on Court Procedures to react to comments from the membership of the bar.
Let me ask you a question. What does that do, or does it do any damage to the promulgation of the rules prior to the next legislative session? In other words, as far as timelines are concerned, will you have the rules promulgated and all of the input feedback periods accomplished by, say, the 2005 legislative session?
My understanding, Mr. Chairman, is all it would do would be to back up the Council on Court Procedures meeting schedules. It would do nothing in terms of their getting their work to the legislature in a timely fashion. What it would do would be to allow them to react to comments from the bar, then resubmit that to the bar, but it would still require them to submit their report to the legislature in a timely fashion as it does now.
All right. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. We'll close the public hearing. Go into work session, House Bill 2087.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burke.
I would move House Bill 2087 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2087 without amendment before the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. And Senator Burdick, would you carry that?
I'd be thrilled, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you so much.
I may have to take some heart medication because it's so exciting. But
That should be consecutive.
Just a couple of aspirin. All right. We're whipping along here. Huh? House Bill 2269. And non-testamentary trusts. This ought to be exciting.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this deals with non-testamentary trusts, which I think we call living trusts or revocable trusts. My understanding of this is that these are more popular because you avoid probate. However, some of the safeguards that are in probate are not currently in them. And my understanding is we're going to be looking at including some of those in the statutes regarding these type of trusts.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chris Klein. I'm an attorney in private practice in the Portland area. And I'm also a member of the Executive Committee for the Oregon State Bar's Estate Planning and Probate Section. And we are sponsoring this legislation. What it will do is coordinate the laws of wills so that they are consistent with the laws currently applied to revocable living trusts. Revocable living trusts, as you probably know, have become very popular as a substitute for wills and a probate avoidance technique so that it becomes the vehicle by which you pass property at your death. However, a number of the laws applying to rules of property disposition that apply to wills do not apply to trusts. What this bill will do is coordinate those laws so that we have consistency regardless of whether you die with a will or a trust. One example is that if you become divorced and you have a gift to your spouse in a will, that gift is automatically terminated so that you don't have to, if you forget to change your will after you become divorced, you don't wind up giving something to your ex-spouse after the property settlement agreement That currently is not true for trusts, but it will be after this law is enacted. The same applies for the rules for what happens if you leave property to a relative, but that relative dies before you do. If you have a will, and that's the case, then the gift to a relative passes to that relative's descendants. Again, that currently is not the case for revocable living trusts, but it would be under this bill. There are a number of other provisions. Those are probably the two most important. But there's a number of provisions that would, similar provisions that would coordinate the laws of both wills and trusts. This bill was amended in the House to add an emergency provision at Representative Shetterly's request. He felt that they ought to become active immediately upon signing.
Okay.
Any questions?
Yeah, I'm going to kind of mess with you a little bit here because we've got lots of time. If you don't
Excellent.
Mind. Would you do me a favor and go through section by section with me? And I'm not an attorney, so it would be helpful for me to maybe understand a little bit better. It doesn't appear that you're doing anything revolutionary here. But
no, this does not change. I'm looking backwards for a copy of the legislation. This does not change any policy if you assume that the law of wills is the policy that you want, the current law of wills in Oregon. It represents a slight policy shift if you actually believe that the laws of wills and trusts ought to be different. But in general, I don't believe that that's the case.
Must not be a big debate because there's no one else here to talk about.
That's right.
Well, we've got definitions, grantor, specific distribution, trust. Section 2, effective marriage. What is this trying to tell us?
This just tells us that if you have a revocable living trust and you're single, the trust is not revoked. There was some question under the prior law whether there was a revocation of the trust because you got married.
Okay, so you have the trust before you get married. You get married, the trust still exists.
The trust still exists, exactly.
All right. Hopefully your spouse understands the effect of that.
Yes.
All right, and Section 3.
Section 3 was the section I discussed earlier, where if you become divorced after you're married, you sign an irrevocable living trust as your testamentary device, and you have gifts to your spouse in that trust. You later become divorced. You go through the proceedings. You have a property settlement agreement. This section terminates the gifts in your trust to your spouse, under the assumption, as with wills, that you've had a property settlement agreement that's fairly divided your assets.
All right, and if this is a trust that's established while you're married, not the one before this.
Correct.
Correct. Single. Correct. All right, Senator Green.
Mr. Chairman, I assume that if continuation of the gift is part of the property settlement, this bill will interfere with that.
Chairman, as Senator Burdick, this section deals only with the trust agreement itself and not the court order. So if there is a court-ordered gift in the property settlement agreement, then this can't sort of affect that gift at all. So I think the answer to your question is yes, it does not affect the property settlement.
Unless the parties agree to something else.
Exactly.
Okay. Morning, sir. Senator Ferry always been down with a host of constituents from his district. So, all right, Section 4, contract of sale of property, not a revocation. What does that mean?
There was some question. Most of these laws deal with things that happened in England about 700 years ago, which is, of course, where we get all of our laws of wills, and so we're trying to apply that same the same set of arcane principles to trusts as well. This is a section that, again, originally with wills, there was a question of whether if you had a contract to sell property in your trust, it would somehow revoke the trust because you're planning on selling the property. This just makes clear that if you are contracting to sell property, it does not do that. The same was true under wills.
All right. So, okay. So that the mere sale of the property does not revoke.
Right.
The trust.
If I say I give my house to you and I sell my house, it doesn't mean I've revoked the trust.
All right. Okay. So that just provides some clarity.
You might not be happy with that, but
there you go. Okay. And Section 5, encumbrances, disposition of property. What is this?
This section, again, is similar to the last section. What it says is that if you encumber or sell a portion of a property that's a specific gift, it doesn't terminate the entire gift. So if I'm leaving something to my son, and I either encumber it or I give away part of it, whatever's left over still passes to him.
I see. Okay. Great. And I assume there have been legal arguments that have caused concern. So I mean, we're clarifying it because somebody's made an argument somewhere that they trust.
Quite candidly, a lot of these provisions I've never even dealt with.
Okay.
What we did as a section was we looked at the current law of wills and went through all of the provisions that would apply to trust or could apply to trust, and we coordinated them. A number of these statutes are fairly esoteric, but we figured that they ought to be equally esoteric for wills and for trusts.
All right. Section 6.
This, again, deals with the question of whether you have property passing to a descendant of a relative if that relative predeceases you. So that if I leave a property to my uncle in a will and my uncle predeceases me, that gift then passes to my cousins, my uncle's children. And now the same would apply for trusts as well.
All right. Section 7?
Section 7 deals with pretermitted children, which are kids that are born after you've signed the document. And there is a long history of what happens in that case for wills. Essentially, if you gave property equally to all of your children, but you named them, you didn't say to my children, you said to Susie and John, and then after John was born and you signed the document, then Michael came along. This would include Michael as a beneficiary. On the other hand, if you cut out Susie and John because you didn't care for them, then Michael wouldn't share in that gift either. So essentially what this tries to do is deal with the situation where you have a child that is born after the document is drafted, and the document does not contemplate afterborn children. As a practical matter, most documents do. So, again, this does not come up all that frequently.
Senator Brady.
Are you saying that if somebody cut out two of their children and then and later a third one was born under this amendment, the third one would be cut out too?
That is correct.
Well, I'm assuming that the trust pre-existed at child birth, correct? So the assumption is that the intent was to cut the children or all children out.
Well, correct. Chairman and Senator Burdick, let me give you an example. Let's say that I've, during my lifetime, made significant, I'm a wealthy individual and I've made significant gifts to my children. My will might say all to charity because during my lifetime I've given enough property and I've included the third child, the one that was born after the signing of the will, in those gifts. This is to some extent, as is the laws of intestacy, a substitution for what we think the testator would have wanted had the testator had a better drafted document.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
So what would happen if they cut out one child and left one child in? Then what would happen?
In that case, you look, let me find the section for you.
What was the question again?
If you cut out one child
but leave the other child in, and you've only named the two children, so then the third one comes along. If you look at Section 7, 3, A and B, it says the pretermitted child may share only in the portion of the trust estate intended to benefit living children. And let's assume you left everything to one but not the other. And then you go to B, it says the share of each pretermitted child is equal to the total value of the portion of the trust estate intended to benefit, divided by the number of pretermitted children plus the number of living children. So what that means is if everything went to Susie and not to John and then Michael came along, Michael and Susie would split it in half.
Okay.
Does that
answer the question? Really.
Again, it's you're going to come up, anytime you have legislation that tries to recreate what a testator was thinking, hopefully, if you get it right 55% of the time, it's good legislation. It's not unlike the intestacy laws. It's quite likely that if someone dies without a will, they would not like the result that they got under the intestacy law, but there's no way we can put ourselves in the shoes of everybody. And again, this section would apply very infrequently because most wills or trusts, for that matter, refer to gifts to children, not to individuals. So if it's properly drafted, this section will never apply to a will or a trust.
All
and it is current law for wills.
All right, Section 8.
Section 8 deals with what happens with property if you make a specific gift, let's say of your house, and then the house is destroyed or there is a condemnation. Do you get the proceeds of the condemnation? Do you get the insurance proceeds following the fire? And the answer is, for the most part, yes, you do get those proceeds. And this section sets forth those circumstances in which you would and how much.
All right. Great. Section 9.
Section 9 simply says that if a specific gift fails, that is, that if I leave my house to a non-relative and that non-relative dies before me, there is a lapse, and then it passes as part of the residue of the trust. This is probably already the law, but it just, since we have it for wills, we've put it in for trust as well.
All right. Great. Well, are we having fun yet?
This is a party.
Section 10.
Wait till the Principal and Income Act comes up later. If you think this is fun.
Makes me wonder why some people do this.
I try not to think too much about what I do for a living. It doesn't speak well for me.
At least you understand it.
Section 10 deals with when, if I have a gift to you in my will and I give you more money during my lifetime, the question is that an advancement on the gift, the testamentary gift in my will or my trust in this case? And for the most part, what this section, as it says for wills, is no, it's not an advancement unless I specifically say so. And then Section 11 deals with how these advancements are made. So sections 10 and 11 kind of work together.
All right. So Section 11, then, if you do want to make that part of the advancement, then you have to specifically say so. And this spells out how you specifically say so.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. 12?
Section 12 is designed to protect bad draftspersons of wills and trusts. If you want to leave property... Well, I'm sorry, let me back up. The federal government taxes you on everything you transfer to somebody. There's a gift tax or there's an estate tax, depending upon whether you transfer it during life or at death. However, one important exception to that is that anything you give to a spouse is subject to an unlimited marital deduction. So when Bill Gates dies and leaves everything to Melinda, there won't be any tax due, regardless of how much he's worth. However, if that property passes into trust rather than outright, it does not qualify for the marital deduction unless you meet certain criteria set forth in the Internal Revenue Code. That is, the trust has to be drafted in a certain number of ways. What this section does is it says essentially that if this looks like a trust that's supposed to qualify for the marital deduction, but the draftsperson did a bad job of it, the trust is automatically amended so that it does qualify.
All right. That's interesting. That's kind of like a sanction to bad lawyering, isn't it?
More or less, yeah. It's
like an errors and omission thing. So, okay.
There's a difference between what we think as a committee and what some of us think individually. But
you know, actually, it probably makes a certain amount of sense because federal law changes, I would assume, tax law changes. Who can keep up with all of that?
Yeah, it's...
pretty complex. Okay. I think we understand that, at least in general principle. Section
13 is not a change until you get down to B4,
okay,
which is on the bottom of page 7 of my copy of the legislation. What this says is that a trustee, when a person dies and the property is to be divided into three equal shares to the person's three children, let's say, the trustee has the power to make non-pro rata distributions. That is, if you know, one child wants the house and the other child wants the cash and it's of equal value, the trustee has that authority to make that division. The trustee is not granted unlimited authority. That is, if the trustee makes a non-pro rata distribution without the consent of the beneficiaries, the trustee is subject to liability for breach of fiduciary duty. But if everybody agrees, this gives the trustee the flexibility to make those kinds of non-pro rata arrangements. It does not mean that they get differing amounts of value. It just means that the assets that they receive might be different. This kind of non-pro rata distribution power is also very beneficial for a number of estate tax reasons that I won't bore you with unless you want me to.
No, I think we're doing well being, well, anyway.
I'm happy to occupy as much of your time as you want.
We've got to get you and Warren Darris
together. Mr. Chairman, Warren Darris is way behind us.
Yeah, okay. Great, and I think that pretty well sums the whole thing up. Yeah. Section 14.
And then, as I said, there was the emergency legislation that was added by Representative Shetterly.
Okay, great. Any questions? Okay. Everybody happy? Good work, Senator.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Did this bump me out of here? Senator Brady.
I would move House Bill 2269 to the Senate floor with a Dukas recommendation, and our good chairman is the carrier.
Ah, that's the motion?
That's the motion,
all right.
Chairman.
I have confident counsel that can help me with this. All right, Senator Brady can move House Bill 2269 to the Senate floor with the Senate to pass the recommendation, not amended, and that the chair of the committee, carries the bill. That's cute. I like that. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Mr. Klein, thank you very much for putting up with us today. Appreciate it. All right, where are we? Let's take a bit of a break. We've got one more bill, 2049, and Mr. Joseph is going to come chat with us about that. So we'll take about a 7 or 8 minute break, and hopefully we'll get Mr. Joseph back.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Joseph. I'm testifying here on behalf of myself on House Bill 2049. This bill actually originated in my firm, Bullivenhauser Bailey. Essentially what it does is it sets a rule that requires that any motion to amend a complaint, a cross-complaint, a counter-complaint, to allege a claim for punitive damages be made no later than 60 days before the date of the trial.
And the response is what, 20 days?
Yeah, the bill you should be looking at is...
The A engrossed.
The reason it was originally... There was originally no time period. The first bill called for 45 days before trial, and that was tagged to the date for the motion for summary judgment. But as this committee will be hearing in a couple days, the new Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure set a date for a motion for summary judgment as now 60 days. So I amended the bill to move the date for punitive damages allegations also to 60 days, so they'd all be the same date, and attorneys wouldn't have to be thinking about a bunch of different dates on when they have to do things. The reason to have this rule is that currently, without any rule on when you can amend to allege punitive damages, sometimes such amendments are made immediately before or even on the day of trial, and it just seemed that, especially in a defense posture, you would want to know if and when punitive damages are going to be alleged for the purposes of settlement, because it would come into play at the time of your settlement negotiations, and it may be a driving factor in settlement. And it also seemed that all of the evidence that one would need to make an allegation would be available at the time that they would be needing to make a motion for summary judgment. This law would apply for both sides, both defense and plaintiffs. Although the defendant often doesn't make an allegation of punitive damages, there are situations where you can have a cross-claim, a counterclaim against the plaintiff that you would want to allege punitive damages, and this would apply to both sides.
All right. Senator Ringo.
Thank you. First of all, just for clarification, the 45 days before trial is the actual trial date. It's not the first scheduled trial date.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo. The date that would be operable for both this motion as well as typically your motion for summary judgment would be the actual date of trial. So if the trial gets moved back, which is common, then this date would also get bumped back. And we actually had in the dash threes, which are now incorporated into the A engrossed, there was some change in language to make that clear that this would be tagged to the date, the actual date of trial.
And I think we're talking 60 days, not 45.
It will be 60 days now.
Yeah, 60 days. I'm wondering whether there's opportunity to for a defense lawyer to say that they won't agree to a postponement to the extent it might open them up to an amendment for punitive damages.
Well, the court can always sua sponte postpone the trial date, and often, you know, one party will move for a postponement, the other party will object, and the court, you know, takes all the circumstances into consideration and moves the trial date anyway. But I suppose there would be an opportunity, just like for a motion for summary judgment, that one of the parties who would be against that motion would say, no, I don't want the trial date moved back. There is, I believe, a savings clause in here that allows the court that if there's good and sufficient reason to modify the dates or make the deadline inapplicable altogether. So there would be a situation where a party would say, I've discovered that one witness I couldn't find before. This witness makes punitive damages arguably appropriate in this case, and I should be able to make the motion even though I'm no longer within the 60-day time period.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I guess one of my concerns about this, it used to be that when you filed the lawsuit, you could include in the initial complaint a request for punitive damages. And that would put the defendant on notice right off the bat that there was a claim. And several years ago, I don't know when it was, 4 or 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we changed it so that you can't seek punitive damages right off the bat. You've got to wait so many days, and then you have to file a motion for punitive damages. And it seems to me that this is kind of creating a window that, depending on how the discovery unfolds, may be kind of a narrow window. Because you can't ask for punitive damages too soon, and you can't ask for them later on either. And that's, I guess, Bill, that's my only concern on this. And I would be more amenable to going along with this if we deleted the first part so that you could at least ask for them right off the bat.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond to Senator Ringo's comments, that was not brought up in the House. The main concern that was discussed in the House was the applicability of when there's a mandatory arbitration situation and whether this would be applicable in that situation. I understand the point that right now it's true you cannot allege punitive damages when you file a complaint, and I'm not sure of exactly what the deadline is or the initial time that you can make that motion. I was under the understanding that it was relatively soon after you filed the complaint that you could move to add punitive damages to the complaint. The main concern that this bill was trying to address was to eliminate the situation where one party suddenly essentially lays out a trump card right before trial, and most of the good opportunities to achieve some kind of reasonable settlement have now passed, and this is laid on the table at the kind of midnight hour when all of the information that was available to the party would have been available 60 days before, and we were trying to make it so that this was brought out in the open in enough time that it be taken into consideration for purposes of settlement.
And Mr. Chair, I mean, I understand a concern, but I don't think that would be very good lawyering on the plaintiff's part to intentionally withhold evidence to lay out a surprise. For one thing, the motion to amend could be denied.
It could be.
It could be denied, and then that plaintiff's lawyer would be out of luck.
I mean, although if I understand correctly, and I'm not an attorney, but if you went to the original process where you just simply added your your affidavit request for punitive damages or however that's whatever, whatever, it wouldn't require the documentation or supporting evidence that I assume this requires. In other words, you have a complaint that's filed, and you can ask for punitive damages, but I don't know that it previously required you to have supporting documents and evidence that the judge would.
Right. I mean, Mr. Chair, it used to be that you could plead punitive damages, and it was simply a matter to be proven at trial.
Right.
And so you didn't have to offer any evidence early on to support it. It was just another allegation, like economic damages or non-economic damages. Then they established kind of a gatekeeper process, so at least you had to
and I can't remember off the top of my head what the standard is, but you had to present some degree of evidence to show the court that they ought to allow an amendment to add to the opinion.
And I think that's the crux of the issue, isn't it, that at some point in this process you have to bring some documentation, some evidence before the court to say, look, we filed our initial complaint. We also believe punitive damages are warranted. Here's our motion to amend our original complaint. Judge, take this into consideration, and you have the various responses, et cetera.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm fine with that theory, except there are a lot of cases where the defense will play hide the ball. And you ask for documents, and they won't give them to you. You try to take depositions, and they produce the wrong person. And it's a long way down the road before you get the document that you, I guess, proves that you do. You are entitled to punitive damages. And I understand Mr. Dosa's point that this bill does allow some mechanism so that if you've got additional evidence late in the game, to me it's just establishing a fairly narrow window.
Right.
And I don't see how that serves the public.
But you're in civil practice. I mean, I assume based on this, if this became law, you file your original complaint with a court, and then if you felt you had strong evidence at that time, you simply do your motion to amend the following week or 2 weeks later. There's no limit. And this just says you have to file it at least 60 days before the trial date. So there's nothing that would stop you from filing maybe the next day for an amendment to your original complaint, is there?
Well, it's just that it narrows the window significantly. And you know, sometimes you go from, depending what county it is, sometimes you do get a trial and 7 months, 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you've got to wait until you file a motion for punitive damages. Sometimes you're going to need to take depositions before you do that, or you're going to need to get document discovery. And it just, so you're not going to be able to request them early on.
Okay. Mr. Joseph?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To respond to Senator Ringo's comments, I'm just looking at the version of ORS 18-535, which is the operable statute that's being amended by the bill. I don't see any limitation to, as the chairman said, bringing a motion to amend for punitive damages almost immediately after filing the complaint. I do know that the bill includes essentially a savings clause that if the defendant was playing hide the ball, if additional evidence was found late in the game, that could be brought to the court's attention to have the court waive the deadline. There are other cases where the deadline may not be appropriate because the parties want to engage in early mediation or early settlement and don't want to run up a lot of discovery until immediately before the trial if a case goes to trial. And I note in just my own practice, most cases in Multnomah County are set for trial about a year after they're filed. They're supposed to be tried within a year, but most often, especially given the budget cuts, those cases get bumped. A lot of those cases go through some form of mandatory dispute resolution, be it arbitration, mediation, or a settlement conference. And it would be important, and it is often important, and I don't often encounter situations where the plaintiff hides the ball or the plaintiff doesn't allege punitive damages, but it's important to know for settlement purposes that if punitive damages are an issue, either for the plaintiff or the defendant, that issue gets brought up sometime before trial, and we picked 60 days as a reasonable date because it's assumed under other civil statutes dealing with motions for summary judgment that both parties will have all their evidence by 60 days before trial, and if either party feels at that point that they're entitled to summary judgment, which means judgment is a matter of law, the jury shouldn't even get the facts are clearly in the favor of one party or the other, they should bring that motion 60 days before trial. And we figured all that evidence should be enough to also make either of the parties bring a motion to allege punitive damages 60 days before trial and not wait until the last minute so that if they do want to allege punitive damages, the other party can take that into consideration to deciding whether to settle the case.
Right.
Senator Burdick.
Are you saying that typically most discovery is complete by 60 days before the trial?
Yes.
And this bill would require that motions for punitive damages be filed and served not less than 45 days.
60.
It would actually be
60. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Got it. So would it be maybe a compromise to say unless, you know, just to make it revert back to the current system if new evidence was introduced on discovery, just to solve the, to address the concerns that Senator Ringo was bringing up, where someone's hiding the ball, to maybe make an incentive for not hiding the ball.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, there is already a provision in this bill that says essentially if the court for good cause can modify the dates, and if that's what you're speaking to, that portion of the bill is already there for situations like Senator Ringo is talking about.
I understand that, but that's the discretion of the judge. What if you were just to say, you know, if there's new evidence introduced, then, or new evidence introduced by the defendant, or made available by the defendant, then all bets are off.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, we could put in language that says if there is new evidence introduced by the defendant, all bets are off. I mean, something along those lines. But I think that the leaving it in the discretion of the judge for good cause, and good cause would include new evidence that was not readily discoverable before. There is one concern about just new evidence is you want to put in a standard that the attorney has taken diligent efforts to find that evidence, and although that is not specifically set forth here, most of the times in my practice when I'm trying to move for a new trial date and I've already agreed to a prior trial date, I have to come forward with evidence that says, you know, I undertook diligent efforts to discover the reason that I might need a new trial date, and I could not do so at the time I previously agreed to the trial date, and therefore I am now bringing this motion as quickly as I possibly can, given the circumstances. And I think that's included in the good cause standard. It would seem like if we started adding a lot of detail to what good cause means, that by implication we might be leaving out other types of good cause that we're not able to consider here, because we just can't think of all the possibilities, be it new evidence or there's an illness in one of the attorney's families, or, you know, a witness, you know, maybe evidence is no longer available, such as a witness passes away. And under statutory interpretation, if we start listing out what would be good cause, we might by implication be leaving out a lot of other things. So,
Mr. Chairman, I also wanted to ask if you thought that by setting this deadline that you might be inadvertently creating an incentive for people to just tack on punitive damages just to make sure that they're covered.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, the motion to amend for punitive damages requires a showing, and the attorney would be certifying by signing that motion that they have studied the evidence and they believe that an allegation of punitive damages is warranted. So while I do see your point that some attorneys might think, well, if punitive damages are at all an issue, I better bring this motion, I guess that's a little bit of what the law is trying to do, is for those attorneys who think there might be a chance of getting punitive damages in this case, let's get that out on the table and have the judge decide it 60 days before trial, rather than having it, for instance, as a motion immediately before trial, which would radically change the trial.
And it seems to me that, correct me if I'm wrong, clearly I'm not an attorney, but the Oregon's rules regarding the filing of an original complaint in a civil lawsuit are pretty liberal. I mean, it's supposed to be established on some set of facts or assumptions or whatever, you know, whatever that complaint alleges. Whereas Oregon used to be fairly strict in terms of what you could put in and how it's proved, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's pretty liberal. And I don't think there's no limitation on how many times you can amend your complaint originally. We're just talking specific to punitive damage issues here. Am I tracking this thing okay? Or?
Well, Oregon is relatively a liberal state in terms of pleading, as most states are. Oregon is still a code pleading state, not a notice pleading state. And for instance, California is a notice pleading state. That requires you don't have to be as formalistic in the way you lay out your complaint, but they're trying to roughly be the same in terms of how liberal they are with respect to your initial complaint. You can amend your complaint once as of right prior to the time that an answer is filed by the defendant. It would be the same for the answer going back. You can amend once as of right within a certain time period, and then after that you need to file leave of the court to amend your complaint. The idea is to get as many of the facts and allegations that are at issue out in the beginning so the parties know what is at dispute, what are the issues we need to talk about. Unfortunately, right now, though, punitive damages, which is a large issue, can be brought up at any time, all the way up until right before trial, and even, I would argue, at trial, if evidence comes out at trial that would warrant punitive damages, one of the parties can make a motion to amend to add a punitive damages claim. Here, we're trying to get that issue out beforehand. We pick 60 days because that's the date for the motion for summary judgment. If, on the other hand, evidence does come out at trial where a new witness shows up or a witness that you've previously known about testifies to something you hadn't heard before that warrants punitive damages, this statute still includes that savings clause that says the party that's interested in amending at that point can say, Your Honor, I wasn't aware of this information when the 60 days ran. I think it warrants punitive damages. I want to have this issue heard. And it gives the court the opportunity to hear the issue. But what we're trying to do is get the facts out early so parties can settle. And we're hoping that by having this issue heard early, more parties will be encouraged to settle these types of cases rather than take them to trial.
Senator Ringo?
Well, I guess it's a couple points of dissent. To say that discovery is pretty much complete 60 days before the trial, I think is, I don't agree with that. A lot of attorneys on the plaintiff's and defense side, just like all of us in our personal lives, don't work on something until the pressure's on. And in an ideal world, 60 days before, you have all your witnesses lined up, you know what they'd say. Federal court requires those kinds of things a lot more than state court. But, you know, I've had settlement calls at home at 9 o'clock before a trial from defense attorneys saying, gee, I finally had a chance to open this file and I see where you're coming from. Could we settle this case? You know, and that's the reality of it. And so there, if facts come up 30 days before a trial or 2 weeks before a trial, or even if Mr. Joseph says in the middle of trial that seem to warrant somebody's behavior ought to be punished, I don't think we should foreclose that. And I guess I would also note for the committee that right now you can file a motion to amend at really anything, but an amendment is only allowed at the discretion of the court, and if there's a showing it won't unduly prejudice the defendant. So let's say there's a motion to amend to add punitive damages the day before a trial, and the judge says, well, that prejudices the defense because they didn't have the opportunity to investigate, to prepare, to plan for these allegations. The judge is just going to deny that motion. So I think is what we're doing is we're going to create a whole set of circumstances where people are not allowed to seek punitive damages. And just to give one example, I mean, punitive damages, go back to the Northridge, California earthquake where the Allstate insurance adjusters went through after that earthquake forging signatures as to who had requested exemptions from earthquake insurance. And they just did that so that a lot of people would not get earthquake coverage. You know, and that's the kind of conduct that punitive damages is designed to prevent, and designed to punish.
Well, what do we think about this? Because this seems to add some clear timelines and puts in the statute some process and makes sense. But what you're really arguing is that if there is evidence that occurs at trial, then why not let the court at that point consider that evidence in a separate motion at trial? But if you're the defense attorney, if something egregious comes up and you say, look, my God, we didn't know about this, then maybe you have a hearing in front of the judge without the jury there and say, look, this is something we didn't know about.
Mr. Chairman, let's say that the plaintiff's attorney was not as prepared as he or she should have been, but 30 days before the trial finally gets around to calling somebody who used to work for a corporation.
The plaintiff's attorney?
Plaintiff's attorney.
Well, and I should feel sorry for the plaintiff's attorney. Give me a break.
Also feel sorry for the attorney. Feel sorry for the aggrieved public.
Well, but the plaintiff has a duty, and the attorney representing the plaintiff has a duty to fully investigate the complaint and represent their client. Is that not correct?
Well,
so 30 days from that, they finally get around to actually doing their due diligence before they go to trial?
It's not due diligence. It's just a matter of there's 1,000 things you can do to get ready for trial, and the reality is sometimes you don't do 990 of them until the last 2 months. And, I mean, that's...
you talk to any attorney out there.
If we're doing the transcript.
What's that? Yeah, ask.
I mean, I can tell you, Mr. Chair, that attorneys do customarily wait until the last minute to get things done because we get those calls as court reporters.
And in some ways, it does make sense because a lot of cases do settle. Well, a lot of cases do settle in the last couple of weeks before trial, and so it's only when, it appears this case is not going to settle, then we start pouring in a huge amount of resources.
All right. Where's the committee on this thing? Is that a break?
Well, I hear both sides. I guess I would be curious as to why we upped the number of days.
Because it coincides with the motion for
summary judgment.
Oh, got it.
The new ORC, the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, have moved summary judgment date from 45 to 60.
I want to remind my Democratic colleagues that this did run the gauntlet of the House Committee, too, by the way. I don't see the Oregon Travelers Association sitting
there. Yeah, I don't see them here either.
Mr. Chair.
Not that you care.
Well, I sent Senator Ringo a note to see if OTLA had weighed in on this because I came in late. Has anybody testified in opposition today?
Nope.
No.
And why is counsel sitting there as a witness?
The reason is
here on time, Senator.
I was in court this morning.
Were you the defendant?
No. I was filing some paperwork.
He's here because he's actually on his own time representing some party that Counselor Bailey.
Okay.
I thought this was a great idea. So
yeah.
Here it is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, a person from my firm, one of the attorneys in my firm, John Kemp, proposed this bill long before I even decided to take this job.
Okay.
And once I and the bill met, my firm decided that they were going to get some very free lobbying.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I would be a lot more amenable to this bill if you took away the requirement at the other end that prevented you from alleging punitive damages right off the bat. I mean, that would solve the problem that Phil was trying to get to.
Well, I wouldn't mind that if you alleged punitive damages at the beginning, but you also had to support it with the facts.
Well, right now we don't require documentation to support anything early on.
I understand, but punitive damages is kind of an extraordinary portion of the civil process.
Mr. Chair, you don't learn about that until you're through the discovery process and find out how egregious the case is. You wouldn't have any idea about that when the case is filed. You might have some
idea. My experience is, of course, bend over backwards for the plaintiff in most civil lawsuits. Mm-hmm.
I guess I see the problem here being in cases where, you know, the information's out there, the lawyer just doesn't find it out by the deadline.
They don't do their work.
Or what if the defense is hiding the ball, that the judge just isn't sympathetic when the motion comes under this saving clause?
If the judge isn't sympathetic, you're just kind of out of luck. I've run into incompetent judges myself in criminal trial.
Let's not count on judicial competence.
But there's an assumption that they are competent. I can point to a few folks that probably wouldn't want to name in this committee because it might end up as a testimony. Testifying in a trial in front of them, but I mean, you know, some of them are dumber than a rock.
Mr. Chair, could I ask you a question on the committee because I wasn't here early on? This doesn't prevent, for instance, in a tobacco trial, you find out during trial that the tobacco companies lied, and you find that out at trial. So assume that they hadn't pled punies prior to the trial starting because they didn't expect the tobacco companies to have lied, and they learned that during the trial. Then does this bill preclude them from amending the pleadings and pleading for punies at that time? And
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, no. They would be able to make a motion to the court, just like they are now, and say, Your Honor, new evidence has come forward. It's apparent that the tobacco companies have lied in that situation, and we believe punitive damages are appropriate. And the judge will get a chance to then look at that evidence and decide whether or not it would be.
Okay.
One of the things, if I could just comment on Senator Ringo's suggestion to eliminate the requirement that a motion be made at the beginning, is that by doing that and allowing punitive damages to be pled in the initial complaint, the court will not get the opportunity to examine the evidence and determine whether punitive damages are appropriate. That's why we right now have the requirement that a motion be made at some point to add punitive damages. It can't just be a simple amendment. In fact, the one amendment as of right that a plaintiff or a defense attorney would get for their pleading, their initial pleading, could not necessarily include a motion for an allegation of punitive damages without a proper motion to the court and the judge deciding whether they're appropriate in that case. But in answer to your question, Senator Walker, if new evidence came forward, that's what the last part of the statute is for.
Well, let me make a point here to clarify this for me. If you get a judge who's not sympathetic or is dumber than a rock, and you're alleging that there's new evidence at trial, and the judge says, I don't agree with you, we're going to proceed, can't you appeal that decision at that point and stay the trial until we...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there would be...
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There would be two opportunities for appeal. There would be what's called the interlocutory appeal, which means you would say, Your Honor, this is such an important issue, and this so prejudices my case that I want to put a hold on the trial and make an interlocutory appeal to the appellate court now on this issue alone. And that's within the discretion of both the judge and the appellate court, I believe, does not necessarily have to accept that appeal either. If that is unsuccessful, then once the trial is concluded, that issue would be one of a number of issues you may appeal to the appellate court. Right. So, yes,
so,
it would be
reviewed. You can make the request that you basically stay the trial.
You can.
No, that's never allowed. I mean, in the middle of a trial, I mean, you know, 99% of the time, you're never going to get a judge or a court of appeal to say, yeah, we'll stay the trial. All right.
That's true, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rengo. It's an interlocutory appeals are unusual.
But if the opinion of the judge is, you know, an adverse opinion and it becomes part of the subsequent appeal, you do have an opportunity for the Court of Appeals to make that point that is, we're not allowed to hear this evidence. I mean, it seems like that process does exist. So. And any defense attorney worth a grain of salt who's done their work in preparation, due diligence as I call it, would make that argument, I would assume, in court. In fact, they'd probably make it even if they thought there was a scintilla of evidence that would support punitive damages. Just in the, you know, likelihood that the Court of Appeals might agree with them. So that's a
little tiny thing.
So where does that material is?
Why do I say something?
Okay. I don't know.
All right. Committee, where are we?
All right, Mr. Chairman, I'm struggling with what the problem is here, how big a problem is, how much disruption this is actually causing. I mean, if there are problems with putting it in, and I'm just trying to weigh whether the problem that we're trying to deal with is big enough to compensate for the problems we're creating by doing it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, punitive damages are unusual. They are not commonly pled. I think part of that is the requirement currently in Oregon to file a motion with the court, and that you have to bring forth proof. You can't simply tack it onto your complaint. But in cases where punitive damages are at issue, and there are a significant portion of them, they're certainly not the majority. The punitive damages often become the driving issue of the litigation. It becomes often the largest aspect of the total damages claimed, and it seems illogical if we want to encourage parties to reach amicable settlements outside of the court process to leave that issue of all the issues out of the process until the last minute.
Doesn't it seem rather unfair that punitive damages could be amended into a complaint at the last minute and the defendant does not have a reasonable opportunity to defend the claim?
Well, Mr. Chair, if it's unfair, the judge would deny the motion. Mm-hmm.
But what if the judge is a jerk?
Well,
or at least he's not sympathetic. I mean, it seems to me it can go both sides. Again, my experience is that the judges are bent over backwards for the plaintiff because they want to make sure that the plaintiff has their day in court, has an opportunity to be heard.
Mr. Chair, I can give you plenty of instances to the contrary.
Well, maybe you can. You certainly have a lot more experience than I do in this area, but, well, maybe it's just more momentary. I don't know.
Has the bar waiting on this bill?
I don't know. They're sitting back there looking nice, pretty today. Here's Monday morning. We're all happy. Senator Rivers kind of sending me in their tizzy, though.
Senator Minnis, members of the committee, Susan Gravy for the Oregon State Bar. The bar did look at this bill, and that's where the savings clause language did come from, because they had some of those concerns with respect to mandatory arbitration and the time frame for punitive damages. So.
And, Mr. Chairman, I did work closely with the Oregon trial lawyers folks, both Teresa and Miller in the House, to amend the language, which is what you see in the Angros version. So.
All right. Senator Rubin, sir.
I guess I would appreciate the opportunity just to take a little slower look at this, and you know, let me look at it closer. And you know,
all right, and
we're not closing the committee down tomorrow.
And Mr. Chairman, I'd be more than willing to work with Senator Ringo and Senator Burdick to address whatever concerns they have regarding the savings clause of the language that should be included.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that. I certainly don't have a closed mind to it. It's just there's a lot of factors involved.
I always figure when the Oregon trial lawyers don't show up, that's a good sign. So,
unless it slipped under the radar screen,
oh, come
but
on.
Mr. Joseph tells me that he works
I don't think so.
With them.
I don't think so. But I don't mind my Democratic colleagues supporting in earnest the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association's position on this bill.
Well, and we all know, Mr. Chair, don't we?
That was a smart little comment.
Yeah, the state gets 50%.
60.
60 now? 60%.
Yeah, and 85% of Oregon businesses are small businesses who are subject to a lot of these suits, too. Just so you know, I think that's a huge deal, since some attorneys practice in what I consider a realm of bribery or coercion.
Mr. Chair, one of my
personal opinion.
My concerns here is that inadvertently it could encourage more, you know, if it's a close call, encourage people to put more punitive damages in at the front end. That's, you know, and I know that there's protections against that, but, you know, I do share your...
But if it's supported by the facts, that it is what it is.
Well, but, you know, on a close call, I think, you know, I just don't want to do anything to encourage them.
Encourage what?
Punitive damages.
So you don't agree with Senator Walker here? You want 60% of the girl?
Oh, no, I do like that part. I do like that part of it. But,
all right, we've had a lot of fun here today.
Good source of revenue.
It's Monday morning, 20 minutes to 10. I think we've exhausted our energy on this one, so at this point, I think we'll close the public hearing. We'll wait for Mr. Joseph to have conversations. As nauseam with my friends. Close the committee. Thank you very much. God bless you and have a nice day.
Did we pass all these?
We did.